Hello, and welcome to this edition of The Zesty Garden. We had a week off for the Thanksgiving holiday, so I hope you are joining with us today to get some helpful tips on how to grow houseplants. Craig Aston, senior lecturer in the Department of Plant, Soils, and Climate at Utah State University, is my guest. And if you'd like to join our conversation, we have an email address. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. We also can have you call us on our 800 number. It's 1-800-826-1495. Or you can also post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Now, I do need to mention, we didn't have Gmail, our Gmail account, 2 weeks ago. We were having problems getting into it. Mainly, I couldn't remember the password. But we did have an email that came in during that program from Hillary. And if you'll remember, we were talking about gluten-free recipes. And she said, it's wonderful that the guest is addressing gluten-free recipes, but it is important to note that not all gluten-free grains, especially oats, are gluten-free. There is a lot of cross-contamination in product and packaging facilities. So I think what she's saying is you just need to check and double-check and make sure that it is like probably stating on the package that it's gluten-free. So thank you to Hillary for sending in that question. And again, we'd love to have you join our conversation. Craig, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. It's good to be here again.
I love this time of year because this is when I begin looking for, okay, what am I going to bring into the house? Now, my wife doesn't necessarily want me to be doing that because I tend to, especially in the living room where we have a huge south-facing window, have lots of plants in there, especially African violet. Because that's what I love. I think there's a genetic trait for being able to grow them, because there are other plants I just, for whatever reason, like an orchid, I just cannot keep it surviving. But an African violet, they grow all over the place for me. So
you just have good karma with African violets, huh?
I don't talk to them. There's a lot of singing done in that room. Maybe that's what
it
is.
Could be what it is. That's right. Well, I think you bring up an important point that once you find something you do well with interior plants, then grow those and do that, because we could spend all of today and the next 3 days talking 24 hours a day about indoor plants and all the possible things that can impact them and help them and go wrong, and particularly with every species. And it's nice that when you find something that kind of works in your environment and your light and your situation that you can connect with and enjoy it and concentrate on those.
So how do you know what to pick out when you're going to the store?
Well, I think the main thing is most of the stores that are selling tropical plants right now are selling, for the most part, ones that tend to do pretty good on the indoors. There's really three, I kind of group indoor plants into three groups. There's the, what we call the tropical foliage, and what most people call indoor plants. And most of those have evolved as understory plants in tropical rainforests, so they do grow in really low light. And they tend to be the plants that can hold up in our low light situations. Another fairly significant group of houseplants are really the potted flowering plants. Now, the extreme example of those are things like poinsettias and mums and gloxinias and calanchoes and cinerarias. They bring a lot of color into the house, but they need a lot more light. And plus, we enjoy them for the flower, and when the flower's gone, they'll keep growing, but then they're not interesting. And in the interior landscape, they will probably never, ever flower again anyway. So they're kind of short-term. Mm. Then there's this third kind of miscellaneous group of things like orchids and bromeliads and citrus that you've got to know those to do well with them. Bromeliads, flowers last for 5 or 6 months, but when they're through, the plant is pretty much through too till it grows another plant. But so you get into some of these more kind of unique plants, then they can be a real frustration if you don't research and learn about them and so on.
The bromeliads are the ones that look kind of like the tops of pineapples.
Right.
They have these beautiful coloring to them.
Yeah. Yeah, they are really gorgeous. And in the last decade and a half, they've become much more popular and actually done a lot of breeding and selecting for them. A lot of them are grown in Hawaii and then shipped to the States and potted up. But they are a very close relative to pineapple.
Oh, okay.
And they are unique that they're an epiphyte, and now that doesn't mean anything to most people, but it's a plant that grows on another plant. Now, a parasite lives off of another plant, but the epiphytes, so like the orchids and bromeliads are both epiphytes, and they grow up in trees usually. And so their roots are mostly for support, and they don't really get a lot of their nutrition and water. They get some from their roots, but most of it comes from the water that catches in just the cups of the leaves. And so watering them is really important to get water into those leaves. And if people don't understand that and they're just watering from the bottom, then they just really go downhill.
I think you just solved an age-old problem for me, why I can't grow orchids.
Yeah, yeah. And the orchids are a little different, but they still like a real barky, high organic mulch to soil to grow in. And they are now selecting four orchids that tend to tolerate indoor situations and a wider range of indoor stress than, you know, there's probably 2,000 different orchids out there. This is a big group of plants.
But you bring up a very good point. If you don't know how the plant lives in its native habitat, how are you going to know how to take care of it when you bring it into your house?
You know, that's right. It's been 15 years ago, and I was at some meetings in Portland, Oregon, greenhouse and nursery meetings. I went to one presentation on the 10 best indoor plants. And I thought it was interesting that the spin this individual put on it. He was a horticulturalist for life, and he'd worked in the interior plant business, and he'd also been a propagator and a grower. And he talked about these 10 best plants, and included pothos and spathiphyllum and Chinese evergreen and dracaena, some pretty common tropical plants. And probably the number one reason they were on his list, well, there wasn't a single reason, but the two or three reasons. One is they do well in low light. And two, they do well over a wide range of cultural conditions. So if they get a little too much water, they can tolerate it. If they don't get quite enough water, they can tolerate it pretty good. So they're kind of forgiving. And that kind of takes us back to your earlier question, how do you know what are the good plants? Well, if you go with that group of plants that have been shown to do well indoors and tolerate kind of these varieties of conditions, they're more forgiving, and people have more success with them. If you get into the more unique plants like bromeliads and African violets are kind of even in that class, you know how to grow them well, but sometimes people don't understand, then you have to have the knowledge on how to love and care for them or what it is that's unique about them. Succulents are another big group of very popular indoor plants. And there's really two kinds of succulents. There's the xeric succulents, which we usually think of, the cactus, and that come from the deserts, but there's also the succulents that come from the wet environments, like rainforests again. And those succulents, if they're, even though they sometimes tolerate a lot of water, they still don't like to be overwatered.
Would an aloe vera be in that category?
No, an aloe vera is actually a desert one, too.
Okay.
But like a rubber, the rubber plant, okay, the jade plant, is really one in that category. And so it actually can suffer from being overwatered. The thing that the rubber plant is different than the cactus, the big difference between those two groups of succulents is that the xeric ones have evolved in full sun, high light. So they need higher, brighter light to really enjoy life. The epiphytic ones, the ones that like a little more moisture, can tolerate, usually come from rainforests under structures where they can actually do much better in low light. Now, you can bring cactus into your home, and they'll usually do well, partly because they live for a long time on stored-up energy.
Mm.
But they usually do not grow very much. They just kind of hang in there and survive.
And gradually use up that energy.
Yeah, whereas a jade plant that grows in lower light could keep growing and putting out new growth, where a cactus, or, you know, a xeric cactus wouldn't. Now, that's that's kind of getting off into another little sideline, but I think that's part of what makes houseplants both challenging and interesting. I mean, there is this group of plants that do very well, and without a lot of knowledge and a big knowledge base in that, we can usually succeed. But then there's this incredible diversity of these other plants that for people that love plants and enjoy plants and like to work with them and maybe do a little research and learn what the unique requirements are, that's where the real plant lovers, I think, have some fun and enjoyment.
Well, that's why I have so many different African violets. I mean, I'll spot a new color and I think, oh, I want to try that one. And I know that I've gotten through my routine of taking care of them well enough to know that, you know, if I do this or if I do that, they'll be taken care of. Mm-hmm. But there are other plants that I kind of want to branch out into and say, okay, how well would this do in my environment? But it really takes a little bit of research. You really should, you know, look up online. We've got information readily available to help select what would work best.
You know, that's what's really good now. Any plant you choose or anyone chooses, if they've got the name that came with it, they can Google and get lots of information. And that'll help them. I mean, compared to what we had 20 or 30 years ago, mm-hmm. where you went to just one or two of a few books, you can get a lot of information on how to care for these.
Do you have any websites that you would recommend that tend to be good, have good information?
You know, I don't. I have not done a lot of Googling myself on for sites, because I do have several good books, and I think I'm content to kind of lock in on a lot of the
ones I'm familiar with. Does Extension have a place for indoor house plants?
That's one area they're kind of weak in. But having said that, that's USU Extension. There's lots of Extension websites in the country. And I'll bet if you get into California and Florida, even Texas, you'd probably have Extension websites with a lot of information on indoor plants.
Okay. Well, you're listening to Craig Aston. He's the senior lecturer in the Department of Plant, Soils, and Climate at Utah State University. We're talking about houseplants. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or you can post to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and send your question that way. Now, with houseplants, if you were someone who just bought an apartment or just bought a home, you've never grown houseplants before, but you wanted to have a little bit of greenery in there, what would you get?
Can
you narrow this list down to two or three to start with?
You bet. I'll give you, you know, five or six that are really pretty easy to grow. Pothos is one of the better ones. It's kind of a trailing plant. Pothos, or devil's ivy is sometimes called, has most of them have a variegated leaf, so a green leaf with either kind of a cream-colored or a yellow stripe in it. But the pothos really do well, and along with the philodendron. Now, there's two or three philodendrons, but the heartleaf philodendron is a smaller leafed, and again, it works great in trailing baskets or in hanging baskets.
So the pothos is one that has kind of an arrow-shaped leaf to it, and it seems like I've seen this in every apartment to begin with.
Yeah.
Because it does seem to take lower light a lot better than
it tolerates low light well. It's really quite forgiving of low humidity, which, boy, in the winters, that's one thing that really hits some of these plants hard. When we turn on our furnaces, circulate that air, and remove more moisture, our humidity drops real low. But the pothos is, it's easy to propagate, and so growers like to grow it, but then it really does well in the interior. One of the most popular of, so both the philodendron and the pothos are trailing plants. They work great in hanging baskets or up on top of a file cabinet or maybe on a table. Sometimes they'll even kind of stake or trellis a pothos to hold it up. But if you want something a little more upright, then the Chinese evergreens, the aglaonemas, have become one of the more popular indoor plants because they've done a lot of breeding and tissue culture work to where they've developed some really beautiful new varieties and different variegations and different looks. And they also do real well in most interior settings. And they'll get as much as 2 feet tall and 2 feet wide, but that's partly a function of how big a container they're in. So they're upright, they don't trail, and they'll work a lot better on a floor, on a table, or something like
that.
And
they take lower light?
Mm-hmm.
Or will tolerate it?
Yeah, these are in the group that tolerate really quite low light levels.
Now, what happens when you take something like the Chinese evergreen and it ends up having bright light, maybe not direct light, but having bright light?
It'll usually do well with it.
Okay.
You know, the brightest light areas you'd probably have in your house are the south windows. And I think any of these we've talked about would be very happy in the south windows. You'd think, well, maybe that's going to burn it. But the reality is on most homes now with double pane and occasionally even triple pane windows, and some of them are lightly tinted, even though that light looks really bright coming into us, it's still not that bright. We've actually, in the class where we teach indoor plants, we take a light meter and put it in direct light coming through a south window and then step outside in that same light. And there's only about a third of that light really coming through the glass. Most people don't appreciate that, but a lot of it just reflects off. So, yeah, even in direct light, most of these will do all right.
And so you've already got lower light in the winter and then put double and triple paned windows in, and you're cutting that even more.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, a south window in the summer, the sun is almost overhead, so we don't get as much direct light. But we have longer days and more light intensity, so there's still a lot of light coming in. Light can be really complicated. But most of these plants tend to tolerate a wide range. Let me talk about one other principle with light that I think helps people wrap their brain around it. Quite often, I'm going to introduce a term that everybody's familiar with, and that's plant food. When we talk about plant food, most people think about fertilizer. But really, fertilizer is like vitamins to us. Plant food is what the plant produces in photosynthesis. And so when a plant can't photosynthesize adequately, then it starts to starve to death. Most plants that grow in greenhouses have a rate of photosynthesis that's about 6 or 8 times the rate of respiration. So they're producing a lot of food. As the light levels drop, that level of photosynthesis to respiration drops. And in a lot of houses, the light level gets so low that photosynthesis and respiration is equal. And that's called light compensation point. And then the plant's actually slowly dying because it has to kind of cannibalize itself. Now, that's a term and a concept that most people are going to say, so what? But at compensation point, a plant will live, but it's slowly dying. And it gets leggy and drops leaves. And people think, well, gosh, this plant needs more fertilizer. It needs more water. Maybe I need to repot it because it's stressing. Well, that's not the problem. It's just starving. And until you get into more light, adding more fertilizer could actually hurt it if that's the problem. And overwatering it is really bad. And transplanting it when it's in at light compensation point really stresses it too. So be careful of that. As it approaches compensation point, they do start to look different. You have to back way back on fertilizing and even back off on watering. And then the main thing is try to get them into a little higher light situations.
So let's go over those points so you know if that's a situation. So the lower leaves are dropping off.
Right.
The plant's just not growing at all.
Yeah.
What else would you look
for?
So
you would start to see if there is any new growth, it tends to be more spindly and the leaves are smaller. But you're right, then these lower leaves start to fall off because they're the ones that were even least efficient in photosynthesis. And that's probably the biggest thing, just less canopy, less leaves, a little bit spindly growth. Maybe some lighter color of green is another sign of that. And so it's nothing you can do about that except try to get the plant more light. Now, having said that, these plants we started to talk about, like pothos and philodendron and Chinese evergreen, they can survive at 7,500-foot candles. But you put things like crotons and palms and ficus in that light, and they'll start to have more problems with that light compensation point problem and kind of starving to death. So when we talk about light plants that do well in low light, this book I brought over with me is a book that I've had for several years that I really like. It's the only book I've ever seen that actually quantifies indoor plants by the amount of light based on foot candles, just not visual light, because that's so deceiving. It may look bright to us, and yet it's really not that bright. And they talk about the amount of light needed for a plant to be at maintenance level. Now, compensation point is where photosynthesis and respiration is equal. Maintenance level is where photosynthesis is 2 or 3 times the rate of respiration. That's kind of an ideal situation for plants. They're not growing too fast, and yet they're producing enough food to grow. And like those African violets in your office are definitely at maintenance level or above. They're happy. They're thriving, and you've got real good light in that south window. And once you have plants that are putting out new leaves and new growth and growing good, then you know that's a good sign for that particular species that it's in a light level that's appropriate.
So I was asking you before the program as we were looking at that plant, because I'd been having some yellow leaves on the bottom. So it's a good sign that I continue to have blossoms, that I continue to put out new leaves. So it's probably getting the nutrition that it needs maybe, or maybe I should give it a little bit more nitrogen maybe to keep those bottom leaves from coming off. But it seems fairly happy.
Well, yeah, so, you know, as I've talked to you, I appreciate that you're somebody that knows quite a bit about plants, even though you're not a botanist or horticulturist.
I get to ask the questions every week.
Well, and so you have a good appreciation for these basic principles. I quite often get calls from people, not as much as I used to, but they'd say, like, okay, I have houseplants. How often should I water them? Or how often should I fertilize them? Well, that's an impossible question to answer because it varies on the species of the plant, how fast it's growing, how big the canopy is, the whole foliage to the pot, the temperature, light conditions. There's a lot of things. So you fertilize, back to your African violets, they're growing pretty good. They're at a good maintenance level or even above, and so they're going to need a little more fertilizer. Those same African violets in a room on the other side of the building without that south light are probably going to be fertilized at maybe half the rate because they're going to slow down even further. And so it is a good sign when there is new growth being put out, the leaves are dark green, and it's not getting leggy. That's just a sign of a plant that's happy and that's growing at probably this maintenance level and does need occasional fertilization and maybe a little more frequent watering. The flip side of that is a plant that's below maintenance level, approaching compensation point. You back off on the watering, you back way off on the fertilizer. They just don't hardly need any when they're just really growing slow.
Now, I have noticed that, I don't know if you saw it, but there was a jade plant that I had in there, and it's a smaller leafed jade. The family across the street moved, and I didn't have the heart. They said, we're just going to throw these out. No, don't throw that out. And so I brought it in, and it's fairly root-bound. And I started watering it a little bit more often, not a lot, but started fertilizing it. And all of a sudden, boom, I got this flush of new jade leaves coming out. But then I noticed that some of the branches were starting to shrivel. And I thought, and they're just dropping off. And I thought, okay, I think I'm killing this with kindness. So I quit fertilizing it, hardly any at all, and it seems to have recovered from it. But sometimes it's just trial and error, unless you look online to know how to or call someone to ask them, how do you take care of this? I've got another plant in my office that's the Christmas cactus. It's absolutely root-bound. But it must love it because it was just flushed with blossoms. Mm-hmm. But I have a feeling if I put my African violet in the same pot, it wouldn't like it very much.
Yeah, couple of points you just brought up. One is this idea of being root bound. I need to take one more step back. My slogan or motto, whatever, for horticulture is there are few absolutes. It's really hard to say, okay, for this plant, for a Christmas cactus, this is what it always likes and this is what works best because there's so many other factors that come into play. So with this idea of being root bound, most of the indoor plants actually prefer to be a little bit root bound. Now, having said that, again, sometimes some it'll stress them. But if you have what we refer to as the head of the plant, the canopy of the plant, can be up to 2 to 3 times the size of the container, and that most plants are happy with that. If it gets so root bound that it actually starts to lift that root ball out of the pot, and I've seen that, then yeah, it needs to be transplanted. But again, most of your indoor plants don't mind having the roots a little crowded. We wouldn't do that with landscape plants or plants growing in containers outside. But on the interior, that's not too bad of a deal. So there is a stage when they're so big that, yeah, you need to replace them. Now, the reason I bring that up is sometimes transplanting them can cause some initial stress, and there might be extra leaf drop and so on, but they usually bounce out of it. The most critical time not to transplant is when they're already really stressed from very, very low light or overwatering or cool temperatures or something. And again, occasionally we think, well, this plant's not doing well. I need to give it fresh soil. Maybe not, and probably not. You need to find out why it's not happy and why it's stressed, particularly if it doesn't have a big, thick, full canopy. There's probably other things working, and replanting it may not help it at all and may actually hurt it.
You're listening to Access Utah. That's the old program. To the Zesty Garden, and Craig Aston, senior lecturer in the Department of Plant, Soils, and Climate, is my guest for the rest of the hour. We're going to take a brief break, but then we'll be back, and hopefully we'll have your questions or comments. Toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and post a comment there. Or if you prefer, you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment.
As the days shorten and gray, our indoor gardens may be suffering. A move to a new location may be the solution. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Moving plants to an unobstructed south-facing window in the winter is often enough to give them the sunlight boost they need. Next, help your plants deal with the dry air indoors. As we turn up the thermostat, the humidity in our house lowers and our plants suffer. Group plants together or place on gravel trays to increase the humidity around your plants. As one plant loses moisture from its leaves or transpires, the others benefit from this added moisture. And as the water evaporates from the gravel tray, it increases the humidity around the plants. Adjust your watering schedule to compensate for reduced light and changes in room temperature and humidity. Only fertilize actively growing plants that need a nutrient boost. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. And we're taking your questions or comments about growing indoor houseplants. You were mentioning pots. How do you know what kind of pot to get if you are going to transplant something or you know, repot it? Do you just get just one size bigger, or do you get a big pot because you don't want to have to repotted a lot?
No, that's a good question. A couple things from the kind of container. If you are repotting because it's now crowding the pot and getting a little bit or getting quite a bit root bound, usually go up about one size more. So if you've got an 8-inch pot, most of them go up in 2-inch increments, go to a 10-inch pot. You could go from an 8-inch pot to a 16. The thing you have to be careful with that is once you put it in that big of a volume of soil, your cultural practices will change. You'll have to back off on watering, maybe. I mean, there's a chance to overwater plants that get too much soil if we hydrate that soil completely. So normally that's why we just step up one container size at a time. And that's not too big of a deal. The other thing that helps when you repot, if you've got a healthy plant that's growing at maintenance level, putting out new growth, is when you do repot, take a knife and cut through that root ball, those circling roots, in just two or three places. Just cut a half inch deep. And that actually stimulates brand new root growth into the new soil that you've just put it into.
So you just slice into them just a little bit.
Yeah, just take like a utility knife and cut about a half inch deep and cut maybe on just two sides those roots that are going around. And wherever you cut, that's root pruning, and that forces new root growth that helps the roots, new young healthy roots grow out into the soil that you've just, the new soil you've put it into.
Now, if you take a plant like a Christmas cactus, I've got one that has it's about a foot across as far as its root ball, and you wanted to get a smaller plant, you don't want to keep going up into larger pot. Can that be done, or does it end up shocking the plant too much?
No, if it's fairly healthy to begin with, you can actually lift it out of that pot and put it in another pot of similar size, and that shouldn't be that much stress to it.
So I could cut through the root ball completely?
Yeah, and just when you pull it out, make a decision. If you've got a lot, sometimes that root ball will be nearly solid roots. It's been so root-bound and been growing so much. If you just have 20% of the surface of the root ball as roots, you may not need to cut, but even one or two little cuts just stimulate some new root growth.
Okay.
You know, one other thing when you ask about containers, and I've been looking at some containers partly because we're getting ready to put new plants or plants in our new Ag Science building. And some of these decorative containers do not have holes in the bottom of them. That is the most basic, simple thing you need for a container for a plant is you need drainage. And if you're going to use these ornamental containers without holes, then you need to put a layer of crushed rock or lava rock or something in the bottom and plant on top of that, or put your production container that the plant came in inside of the decorative container. That's probably the best thing to do. So, number one, never plant into a plant without holes in it unless you compensate for a reservoir on the bottom where the extra water can collect.
Now, some plants prefer more like a clay pot or a terracotta pot versus plastic versus, you know, how do you know what a plant's going to like?
Well, I think the ones that like the terracotta are the ones that have a tendency to be susceptible to overwatering because the terracotta breathes out the side. But that's almost a non-choice anymore. Most of the stores are just selling plastic, fiberglass, sometimes metal, or ceramics, clay with ceramic on them, which doesn't breathe either. The good old straight clay is kind of hard to find. I mean, you can still find it, but you have to look for it.
I know with my African violets, they like to be watered from the bottom. And so I found these really cool plants that have the opening at the bottom for watering. And so then that works out really great. And then I also found this other pot. It's a terracotta pot. It's a pot within a pot. And so I take out the African violet, which is in the inner pot, fill up the other one with water and set it back down in, and it's just breathing through, taking that water through the pot.
Absorbing the water through the container, Yeah, I've seen that for African violets too. And African violets, and you bring up an important issue about those, you don't overhead water them, or at least don't get water on the leaves because that damages the leaves unless it's room temperature water. So that's often why they water them from the bottom or through those pots that'll take it in through the side.
Where are they native to? Why would that be the case where they can't get water from overhead? Are they in a dry climate?
You know, I don't know. But if it were tropical, I really don't know. The rain that comes is warm, you know. It's when we take tap water that's cold and water a plant that it hurts. But, that's a question I'm not sure of when it comes to the African violet and where it's native to.
Would that be most plants prefer to have room temperature water?
Yeah, actually, that's most plants like that. And particularly sometimes once you let the cold water run for a while, it gets really cold. Mm-hmm. And you've got a root ball, the soil is at room temperature, 70 degrees or maybe 65, 70 degrees. But you put that 40-degree water on there, that it doesn't necessarily hurt them, but it has a little bit of shock, and some plants are a little more sensitive to it. So, yeah, I think it's not a bad general rule to water with just kind of room temperature water. That's probably best for almost all plants.
I've noticed that when plants get moved from one environment to another, that how it changes the dynamics of the plant. For instance, Will Pitkin, who passed away recently, when he moved from the Logan area from Hyde Park, he gave me this humongous aloe vera plant. It's probably about 2.5 feet in diameter. And he had it in a really good light all the time. And I just have the south-facing window. And sometimes during the summer, I would stick it outside. But I brought it into the house and put it underneath the piano and just got this south-facing light. And it put out a flower spike. Hmm. I've never seen an aloe vera blossom. And the same thing happens with my mother's jade plant. She's got one of those jade plants that the trunk has gotten about 4 or 5 inches in diameter, and it always tips over, and she has to break pieces off. But it blossoms because of where she put it. And I've never seen jade plants blossom before.
Your jade plant's in the agave family. And the agaves are these group of plants called monocarps that only bloom once. Like a century plant. And century plants, if you've lived in California, people know century plants. They're great big. They look like big, big agaves. And when they do bloom, actually, we had a century plant in the biology greenhouse on campus here about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. They finally bloomed, and the big flower spike came out of the bottom and actually pushed a pane of glass off the top, and they had it in the newspaper. And I'm not really sure. And I don't think even scientists know for sure what it is that finally triggers that. But once that agave or that aloe vera or century plant blooms, that particular plant slowly dies, but there's usually these pups or these other plants growing from the base of it that then take over, fill in, and will grow on.
And do they come on more after it's blossomed?
You know,
because that would sure explain where all of these came from all of a sudden.
Yeah, yeah. They're almost always putting out a few tillers or pups, but I think right before it blossoms, it'll probably increase that. And so if you ever have an aloe bloom, then you watch that, and that particular plant, there may be four or five in the pot now. They look kind of grown together. But that particular one, you'll start to see the leaves go soft and slowly die, and you think, oh, what's going wrong? Well, that one's just done with life now.
Okay.
But you're right. Most people don't see their aloes bloom because it's a pretty rare occurrence. I think it does need pretty good light for it to ever bloom indoors, and then it takes probably just several years.
So maybe it was just because I set it outside during the summer. It wasn't in direct light. I didn't want to burn the leaves, but it got quite a bit of light and then brought it in.
That could have been the trigger, just that extra light of summer. And that's another real good point. If you ever want to put your indoor plants outside to feed them better with light, you know, that using photosynthesis for the term of food production, don't ever put them in direct sun. Put them like on the north side of a house or in partial shade, because going from indoors direct summer sun outside will usually just burn most of the leaves. They just can't tolerate that high of UV light and light. So
yeah, it certainly did it to the first jade I ever had. It not a good thing. But the upside to this was, after I did figure out, okay, I burned the leaves and I need to put it in less light, the leaf color changed on the jade. It went from the green to more of a reddish brown, which was quite pretty. It was really interesting.
Which is probably more the normal way it would look outside, but yeah. And a lot of these plants, if you do burn those leaves off, they will then put out a new flush of leaves. It doesn't necessarily kill them, but it can make them look pretty bad for a while.
Well, we've only got about 3.5 minutes left, and I wanted to make sure that we addressed, you know, basic watering and how to feed the plant itself. And you had mentioned that, you know, really when you're feeding the plant, it's the light. But as far as giving it its vitamins, as it were, how often should that be done? Is it less in the winter when it's not growing as much, and more in the summer when it is?
Yeah, as a general rule, you'll fertilize about half as much in the winter as you do in the summer, and then kind of increase and decrease as you go from spring and, you know, from winter to summer and so on. And then along with the idea of what we've talked about earlier, if you've got a plant that seems to be really struggling and is growing really slow because of low light, infrequent fertilization. But if it's growing, seems pretty happy, then yeah, fertilize it pretty regular, about what it recommends on the container of fertilizer, but then back off in the winter. Another important issue with fertilizing indoor plants is use fertilizers blended just for indoor plants. The big difference for those is that they're a much reduced concentration of nutrients. You know, you put on a tomato plants or flowers outside, maybe a 16, but on an indoor plant, you put on something that's probably a 3-4-4, just a real smaller percentage of fertilizer, because you just don't need as much.
They're just not growing as much.
Yeah, they're just not. The demand's not there for as much.
Would you say that the number one issue for why plants die is people overwater them?
You know, I think there's, from what I've seen, there's probably more of a propensity for overwatering than underwatering. Because when a plant's being overwatered, it actually starts to wilt. Because once that soil root ball stays too wet, it actually can't respire to take up water. And so what happens if it starts to wilt a little bit? We water it even more, and we drown it. Now, and in indoor plants, one thing that causes that is if you're watering it too often and it's in a saucer where there's water standing in it all the time, watch for that. You should not ever water if there's still water standing in the bottom of that saucer, if you can see it. Probably the best thing you can do to tell when it's time to water is just feel the top of the soil, the touch method. If it feels dry, then maybe water. But if it still feels moist, even though the plant looks like it needs water, it's probably got too much water.
Quick question from Josh. He wanted to know, how about growing things like spinach or other vegetables indoors? How can you ensure their success?
Build an atrium or a lean-to greenhouse. Vegetables are really tough, nearly impossible to grow indoors. Herbs, on the other side, and spinach grow so fast, if you've got a real good south window, maybe you can get it up and grow it and harvest some. But really, you need micro greenhouses.
I know, or you can get these grow domes with the lights on them.
Right. And that's the other thing, is a little dome with a fluorescent light and have the light right over the plants. The closer that source of light is to the plant, the more light it gets. So that way you could grow particularly your microgreens and greens and maybe some herbs. But most of the vegetables like tomatoes and cucumbers, you'd have to have big, big lights, and they just aren't going to grow.
Not worth all the effort.
Yeah.
Well, and it's kind of nice to enjoy. I know I appreciate zucchini a lot more when I'm not able to have it for at least 6 months out of the year.
Yeah,
so
yeah, it's nice to – it's great. I love zucchini too, but it's nice to take a break from it too. So,
well, Craig, we've reached the end of our time. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Craig Aston, is senior lecturer in the Department of Plant, Soils, and Climate at Utah State University. Coming up next is Petals and Prose, and you'll be hearing a little bit about Dyer's Woad and snails from Helen Cannon.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. One of our listeners wrote to me about the people who now own Chadwick's Gardens. It's now Willard Bay Gardens. And I had read from an essay I had written about Mr. Chadwick. This is the story about Della, who now owns Willard Bay Gardens. And he tells about how she is continuing in the spirit of Byron Chadwick. On one occasion, he says, "I watched as she cut the blossoms off a beautiful group of plants. I wasn't familiar with that plant and asked why she pruned it in that manner, thinking that maybe it was for the health or future health of the plant. Her response was interesting. 'I take the blossoms off because I don't want the next few customers who walk in to buy it just because it's in beautiful blossom now.' She explained this was a rare plant and it deserved an owner who would recognize its rarity, beauty, and special needs. In other words, I believe," she said, "the person who owns this plant needed to understand the stewardship he should give if he purchased the plant." Another local friend who teaches in the English department where I once taught provided, without knowing, material for what I want to talk about today. And that isn't petals and prose, but weeds and garden pests that every gardener has to contend with. I want to read a few passages from Evelyn Funda's newly published book called Weeds, A Farm Daughter's Lament, which is almost a mystery story, even though it's nonfiction, because she's trying to unearth the deeper and truer truths about her parents' lives. Her mother had escaped from her native Czech homeland in the bottom of a wine barrel. That was when the Nazi occupation was in force, and so she was able to leave Czechoslovakia and eventually come to the United States, and where she and her husband had a farm in Idaho. And the book called Weeds, a lot of the chapters are the names of weeds: Dodder, Loose Strife, Wild Oats, Cheatgrass, and the one I wanted to talk about, Dyer's Woad. She tells about how, for some people, a weed is not a bad thing, but a good thing. And this reminds me of a quotation from George Washington Carver, who said that a weed is a flower growing in the wrong place. So Evelyn Funda takes the same tack, claiming that having read a book written when she was just a little girl by Joseph Conkener entitled Weeds, Guardians of the Soil, claiming as the first book written in praise of weeds. Conkener dares to suggest that weeds may well be of inestimable value to mankind. As perspective like this one, he argues, weeds perform a number of valuable services, for instance, transforming alkaline hardpan soil into tillable and depleted topsoil. These services are so valuable that he advocates the perspective of looking at weeds benignly as companion plants, partners that can actually nurture healthy growth in crops, mother weeds, he calls them. And then she gives an example, the example of Dyer's Woad, which to some people is a great virtue of a plant and to some a real problem. Consider, she says, the plaintive name of Dyer's Woad, a plant that decorates empty lots and mountainsides alike near my northern Utah home with waist-high foliage and neon yellow sprays of cheerful flowers that sway in canyon winds. Although its name suggests an unhappiness so dreadful that it took a redundancy to express it, I used to think it was Dyer's Woe. The yellow-flowered plant's name actually comes from its use, dating back to medieval times as a natural way to dye fabric. Oddly enough, a beautiful violet blue that we call French blue. With a distinguished history, Dyer's Woad is considered an elite dye in Europe, where royalty were buried in woad-dyed cloth. In the Blue Triangle, the region of southern France, it was said during the Middle Ages that those who cultivated woad would simply lie back in the sun and watch their money grow. And I have a French-Hungarian friend who confirmed that Dyer's Woad really made southern France wealthy. Yet, going back to Evelyn Funda's book, she says, yet in the Rocky Mountain region, this very same plant is the villain with a price on its head. Cultivating it is illegal, and farming-related agencies consider it a dangerous, invasive weed that has caused millions of dollars of damage to ecosystems abutting cropland. County extension agencies urge citizens to report it to a weed hotline when they see the plant spreading into new territories. A cooperative of Idaho and Northern Utah weed management agencies have even set up a bounty system for collection of the woad plants pulled or dug up from rural areas, and they aim their Bag of Woad programs to children by distributing colorful pamphlets punctuated with promises of riches, $10 per 40-pound bag, and a series of ominous puns about having woad rage and being a woad warrior. The same plant that is revered in the south of France is vilified where I live. There's also the consideration every gardener has, not only of weeds, but of pests. I have a favorite book called Clementine in the Kitchen, where an American couple living in the south of France hire a cook, Clementine, and what is a terrible pest to us is a great find for Clementine, and I'll read you just a little bit of that. Within the week after Clementine came to preside over our kitchen in Senlis, the Beck family realized what a treasure it had found. One cool evening after her dishes were washed, we watched Clementine take an exploratory stroll in the garden. A rather picturesque bit of rural architecture with a steep roof. It had been a rainy day and the ground was humid under her feet as she disappeared around the corner wall. Suddenly she came into view again, visibly excited. She rushed up to us wide-eyed and then gulped and regained her composure before breaking the news. Mais madame, vous avez des escargots dans votre jardin. Well, excuse my French, but she has just said, madam, you have snails in your garden. This breathless information came as a thunderbolt to the Beck family. We rushed down to the garden in the semi-obscurity. An incredible evening promenade of snails greeted us, dozens and hundreds of them, deserting their daytime retreats in the deep recesses of the wall. They had come out in droves. They clung to the branches of our dwarf pear trees like baubles on a Christmas tree. Anyway, the family gathered these snails and put them in cardboard boxes, because, as Clementine explains, she can't cook them yet. They must fast themselves. They should be kept captive for a week, and then we can prepare them. And so, to give the snails enough parading space to divest themselves of their impurities, Clementine hit upon the idea of allotting a cardboard shoebox to each 3 or 4 dozen snails. Then one night, about midnight, they heard strange crackling noises arose intermittently from the kitchen. Philosophe, the family cat, usually a phlegmatic animal, seemed disturbed and made restless sounds. When finally we padded downstairs in our slippers, a rare sight awaited us. Every one of our snails was on parade. Many of them had loftier aspirations and were proceeding up the walls and across the ceiling. Here the traction was not so good, apparently, and the snails lost their grip and had fallen to the floor, shell and all, making the peculiar crackling noise that had waked us upstairs. It took an hour of ingenious acrobatics and cautious stepping about to contain truant flight, but finally we had them all assembled, except for the cracked and fallen ones, in a well-sealed wooden crate. When it came time to prepare a petit gris, I was curious about the authoritative recipe that Clementine knew about. With a troubled look, she brought out her green covered cookbook and gave it to me. It's here, monsieur, and it is very good. But I should warn you that monsieur who wrote the recipe is long-winded and full of silly words, and I think he's something of a farceur. She meant that the recipe was florid, which again refers to both flowers and language. The recipe that greeted my astonished eyes is such a unique document that I can't resist sharing it with you. It is written by Georges Lecomte. With only a few deletions, here is a fairly accurate translation. Escargot de Bourgogne. If you ambush them in the morning while they are parading nonchalantly on a humid leaf, when their slow, fleshy promenade makes one think of the throat of a voluptuous woman shuddering under a gross and clumsy caress, the snail, sticky and thick, carries its light shell with a facetious air and projects or contracts its horns so lasciviously elastic as the mood pleases them. He irritates you with the little tactics of a gluttonous beast, rampant on his well-filled stomach, everlastingly the same greedy quest. So he tells about, the recipe continues, you next cloister your snail in a cool cellar, and regardless of its own ideas of hygiene, you invariably nurse him for 8 days on green and succulent lettuce. Is exactly as you stuff a nursing mother with lentils in order to have better milk, even though the good woman is regarding such fattening fare. On such favorable tidbits, our beasts are to enrich themselves, and what noble flesh it makes, rich, velvety, worthy of a princely banquet. Finally, having arrived at the paroxysm of murder, you contemplate these soft, submissive snails, and as one possessed of a cruel frenzy, you strip their green outer skins. All that remains for you is a delicate routine of an artist, a sumptuous chef, ce charmant. A radiant copper casserole spread out, this flesh has ceased to suffer, accompanied by the traditional bouquet garni of bay leaf, parsley, and thyme. Well, the recipe goes on in this florid manner, and I recommend to you a delightful book, Clementine in the Kitchen by Samuel Chamberlain. This is Helen Cannon with words about weeds and pests with Petals and Prose.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.